When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Prevail, c'est ce que je n'avais programmé pour politique.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimine organisé, dinero sucio.
Globale corruption. Ta brutale sa démocratie.
Et ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Greg Oliver.
I'm Greg Oliver. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Arthur Snell is here. Of course, he's been here before. Arthur is the longtime British diplomat. He's now retired from the Foreign Service and works as the managing director at Orbis Business Intelligence. He has a podcast called Doomsday Watch, which it's kind of a grim title, but it's a really great look at what's going on around the world in these places where there is conflict or potential trouble. He interviews a bunch of experts in these areas, and it's really a good way to find out what's going on. One of my favorite podcasts. I encourage you, if you don't listen to it already, to subscribe to that. And he has a new book called How Britain Broke the World, where he kind of goes through various points starting in 1997 in Kosovo, and each chapter is a different moment in history that Britain, in his viewing, kind of could have done things differently and how everything contributed to the mess we're now in. But I wanted to have Arthur on because, my God, things are going wacky across the pond, and I needed him to come here and explain to us what's going on, what's the deal with Liz Truss, why was the pound cratering a week ago, etc., etc. I'm recording this a bit earlier than usual. It's the 4th. It's Tuesday morning, 10-4 here in the States, 4-10 everywhere else. Makes more sense to do it 4-10, doesn't it? I don't know why we do it the way that we do it. Anyway, I'm recording a little bit earlier than usual this week. If anything happens between Tuesday and Friday, I apologize. I'll get to it next time or possibly on the 5-8. As you're listening to this, I am en route back from Washington, D.C., where I spent the last couple of days. Haven't been there in a long time. Wanted to go back and soak up all the great Georgetown kind of culture and vibe. And you know, I wanted to talk to a few people, see what was going on. I hadn't been back there for quite some time. I was going to go to my college reunion, and it was in May of 2020. So, of course, that got canceled because of the pandemic. And I never made it back. And it's already like it's almost, you know, we're heading on 2023. And I feel the need as an American citizen and someone who spent 3 years of my life down there, I felt the need to go back to D.C. and sort of recharge. So anyway, I'm driving back as you're listening to this. As I'm speaking, I haven't been there yet, so hopefully everything goes according to plan. Interview with Arthur is terrific. I don't want to waste too much time up front prattling, especially since I've prattled enough this past week, and it's still early enough that no major news has dropped other than I guess Dr. Oz likes to kill animals, but nothing about that guy surprises me. Look, he refused to give up his citizenship in Turkey, and Erdogan is bad. That's all you really need to know about this guy, and the fact that the polling is so close with Fetterman is ridiculous. And guy doesn't even live in Pennsylvania, people. He doesn't care about you. He just wants power. It's a naked power grab. This is a bad actor, literally a bad actor, because he's terrible at pretending to be a politician. Vote for Fetterman, for God's sake, and not the foreign national with close ties to the Erdogan government, who, doesn't even live in Pennsylvania. All right, enough prattle. We'll be right back with Arthur Snell.
Got room for one more if you still want to go to Aspen.
You didn't know.
Where did you find that?
After a woman leaves a briefcase at the airport terminal,
I don't know what's in that.
A dim-witted limo driver.
It's just meat.
And his even more dim-witted friend.
I'm not eating that.
Set out on a cross-country road trip to Aspen.
See the movie? They catch up to him half mile down the road and slit his throat.
Eat it.
Along the way, the limo driver realizes his friend is a serial killer. Netflix presents a new film by the Farrelly brothers, Dumb and Dumber. Now streaming.
Some kid back in town?
Arthur Snell, welcome back to Prevail.
It's great to be back, Greg. How are you?
I am well. How's your summer been? You've been busy, I know that, but have you had any fun at all and done anything interesting?
Yeah. In fact, I came to North America, but not to your great country. I was in Canada for a couple of weeks on a lovely family vacation and, this and that. And, it's been good.
Okay, that's good, because you've been busy. I mean, you have a book out, How Britain Broke the World. We're going to talk about that later on in the podcast. It's very good. I'm going to encourage people to read it again. We'll talk about it later on. You've been doing your Doomsday Watch podcast, which is excellent, because I think originally and still it's conceived as this sort of serialized thing where it's planned interviews and it's this. And now since the war broke out in Ukraine, you've been doing these war dispatches, which are super valuable. So I hope people listening subscribe to that. I'll put all the links and stuff into the show notes. But I wanted to have you on because, like, stuff's getting weird over there. And we need to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah. What the hell is going on?
Well, let's start here. Okay. So you've got yourself a new monarch, King Charles III. Okay.
That is correct.
The choice of name suggests perhaps an ignorance of history, because things didn't go so great for the first two guys named Charles. I joked he should have called himself Ethelred II, because he could have been Ethelred the Ready rather than the Unready, because he's been waiting for this job, right? His whole life.
So as opposed to the that's good.
Yeah.
But also, as being called Arthur, I mean, there was some rumor that he might choose to be called King Arthur, which obviously I would have been very happy about, but no, it didn't happen.
I think the Monty Python.
You know, right. Well, that maybe Monty Python killed that story, but there is supposed to be this kind of legend that King Arthur is sleeping in a cave, and he's going to come back when Britain is in its direst moment. And you know, I feel that we might be in our direst moment. You know, this might be right now we need King Arthur. But anyway,
I think, and you instead you have Charles III. Now I don't want to dwell on this too long, but the Queen obviously was extremely popular, great source of national pride. Charles, maybe not so much. Where do you see this going? Is this going to be the impetus to break up this monarchy finally, or is something else going to happen? But what do you think is going to happen with this?
Well, it's a great question. I think for the first at least a year and maybe a bit more, I'm sure everyone will kind of rally around. It's a bit like the honeymoon with a new president. I mean, obviously, no one voted for this guy, but there's some similarity in that the media will give him a quiet time and talk about all the good things they've done. And to be fair to King Charles, and I'm not heavy monarchist. I'm not a kind of full-on Republican, but He's done some good things with his time. He's done sort of youth development charities and he's championed this sort of environmental cause even before it was a big deal. So he's not, you know, there's the other bit of the story about his first marriage and how he treated Diana and how all the time he was going on with Camilla, who's now his wife. So, you know, it's a mixed story. But I think for the first few years, he's going to be fine. But I do think that he is fundamentally, he seems to be quite a brittle character, quite prickly. There's a few videos have already gone viral of him kind of losing his shit over really small things like the pen not working or something. And I think ultimately it's going to be hard for the British public to kind of love him and in a way that they really did love the Queen. And so, yeah, it gives more impetus to the kind of long-term question about do we really want to do this with a hereditary, you know, a hereditary billionaire who runs our country for us? You know, it's quite a weird system. His eldest son, William, and his family, you know, they're all, I think they're still pretty popular. So I'd hesitate to predict the end of the British monarchy anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think so either. Okay, so moving on to more important things, you mentioned the need for King Arthur to reappear here.
Yes.
Liz Truss, and I think last time you were on, you said, oh, Boris Johnson is going to be around for a long time, and now he's gone.
That's
Liz Truss has been prime minister, astonishingly, for less than a month, right?
And
she's presided over the death of both the Queen and the economy. What's going on? Like this,
I know.
Pound is in freefall. Should we be buying pounds for arbitrage purposes? Well, first of all, what's happening? I mean, I don't understand.
Okay, so we have to start at the beginning. That Liz Truss to become appointed prime minister. Obviously, we have a parliamentary system. It's not a directly elected head of government in the way that you would have with a presidential system. So you are appointed prime minister by the monarch. So Liz Truss flew up to Scotland, where the Queen was sort of finishing her summer vacation, and shook hands with the Queen, and there was a little picture of that happening, and it looked charming. And within, I think, 24 hours, the Queen had died. Who knows, you know,
inauspicious.
Have that impact on someone to be so boring that you bring about the death of someone who's done that job for 70 years. That in itself, that was what you might call a bad start. Then things were the country was completely focused on the death of the Queen and the funeral and the state mourning. And as you can imagine, there was no space for Liz Truss really. But so she didn't do anything bad. She didn't do any good. She was just in the background, and we were focused on that the solemn funeral and all the ceremony. And then. Then was the big moment, her first big moment of being prime minister. She did, an important person that we have to bring into this is her Minister of Finance, or as we call it, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kwasi Kwarteng, unusual name. He's a guy of Ghanaian heritage, but born in Britain. By all accounts, hugely intellectual. He was a professor at Cambridge University. He's been at Harvard. Every scholarship you could get, he's got those scholarships. But I think he's an example of how sometimes the people with the highest IQs are some of the stupidest people you can ever meet. Truss and Kwarteng together, they come from this kind of super small state, kind of right wing. I suppose it's a bit like the kind of Paul Ryan wing of the Republican Party. So they're not like right wing in that Trump way with the kind of white nationalism or anything like that. But they're super right wing about the small state, about cutting tax, about cutting back public services. And of course, they just had this sort of very narrow-minded idea that if they announce that they're cutting loads of taxes, even if they're borrowing to fund the cutting of the taxes, then the markets are just going to say, woohoo, this is brilliant. You know, we're the hedge fund guys are going to be happy. The bonuses are going up. The bankers can make out. And, you know, that anyone who's on a low income, well, you know, it's that kind of 1980s Gordon Gekko stuff that, you know, the Wall Street's going great and people on low incomes will find their way because the economy is humming away. It's a sort of classic kind of small state capitalist outlook. Now, of course, the problem with that is you might be able to do that in the US, where ultimately, you know, the dollar is still the sort of global reserve currency. And you might be able to do that if there is not a global crisis driven by Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine, energy prices sky high and all that. But I think in particular, the bit where they said they were going to cut taxes and fund that by borrowing money, that's where the market said, you know, this just doesn't add up anymore. And so the pound just started going through the floor. And perhaps more importantly, that the borrowing costs, that the UK bonds, government bonds, they just started, you know, tanking. And ultimately, as you all know, in any kind of sort of secure Western economy, G7 economy, if the government can't borrow, basically you hit the wall. Yeah. So that they managed in the space of sort of 24 hours to go from being a thinking that they were these kind of small state sort of, you know, right wing, small state kind of Reaganism, but with less public borrowing. And they went from that to just looking like the sort of Keystone Cops. You know, they had no idea what they were doing. And then things got worse because you've got the pound tanking, the government borrowing is going out the window. The pension funds are getting worried. Some of these pension funds thought they might go bust. And obviously, you know, then you've got the retirement, you know, people's retirement packages screwed up. And neither Liz Truss nor Kwarteng, the chancellor, would say anything. They disappeared. It was as if they'd both been kidnapped or taken hostage or something. It was really weird. And then finally, the Bank of England stepped in. And of course, the Bank of England operates separately, a bit like the Federal Reserve. And they basically stepped in and they spent £65 billion, which is now basically $65 billion. It used to be worth a lot more, but now we're basically one-to-one, to stabilize the markets, to basically bail out some of these pension funds that were going to go bust. And then Liz Truss popped up and she did a series of radio interviews. And those interviews will be used by a kind of media and journalism training courses for years to come as case studies of how not to do an interview. She would be asked a question, and then you just hear this long silence to the point that you check your radio, like, has it gone wrong? Have I lost the signal? No, she's still there. She just doesn't know what to say. So she's managed in the space of less than a month to go from being kind of somebody you don't know really who she is, but she's been around on the political scene. She's one of these ambitious young conservatives. I mean, I'm not a conservative, but you think, well, she's probably, you know, she's like all the others. She's just somebody who's going on. She's gone from that to being seen as someone who has absolutely no capability whatsoever to be prime minister. And so her party was about 10 days ago, they were sort of 10 points behind, which is, you know, midterm. That's not impossible. You can come back from that. The election's not due till 2024. They're now 30 points behind in the polls. So they've had a 20-point collapse in the opinion polls in the space of like 5 days. So, yeah. And the problem is, we're here now, you know, speaking on the weekend. There's still 18 months at least till the next election. And the Conservative Party are kind of saying, can we get rid of her? I mean, I know she's only been here for a month, but maybe we could just get rid of her. But under the rules, that she's supposed to have at least a year before they change prime minister. So it's like everybody's sort of throwing up, you know, sort of throwing their toys out of the playpen and wondering how they can survive with this unbelievably incompetent prime minister who's proved to be completely incapable in just 4 weeks. And you think she's going to be here for 52 weeks more, or, you know, 100 weeks, and you know, in 4 weeks she's shown that she can't do the job. So that's kind of where we are right now.
I mean, we know what it's like to have an incompetent president, certainly, you know, somebody incompetent in charge. We had ours for 4 whole years, although you know, Trump was competent in certain areas, and I guess there were certain things that were fail-safes that prevented him from doing whatever. But I think a lot of that job is just presenting as confident, especially with matters of the economy. At the end of the day, the economy is just a matter of faith, right? So Winston Churchill was prime minister and was the antithesis of this. Even when the going was tough, just presented as this very confident, very sure, you know, guy that you can kind of rally behind. She seems to have none of that at all.
Nothing.
What I don't understand is, Boris Johnson, obviously terrible, but did have charisma and was able to talk and fake it, I guess. I don't understand. Is there nobody there on the other side, on the labor side, that's good enough? Like, what can you guys just run like David Beckham for prime minister? Like, can you do it? Like, why can't you find somebody that isn't a conservative?
I mean, there's so many options.
I'm half joking, but I'm serious. Like, why isn't the opposition party stronger, I guess?
Yeah. Well, I think that so the current leader of Labour is a guy called Keir Starmer, and he was the sort of the equivalent of the head of the DOJ. So he was the sort of chief prosecutor of the whole of Britain. And he's got a very serious background as a lawyer. And he worked both in private practice and prosecuting, you know, big terrorism cases. So people look at him and they see that he's a serious guy. But I guess he's a kind of a bit like John Kerry or someone like that. He comes across as a bit boring, a bit stiff. And people who like him respect him, and they respect his public service and his sort of character. But they don't see him as a kind of exciting, inspiring guy. But I think there's no debate now that the Labour Party is most likely, I mean, on the current polling, they'll be a landslide, you know, they'll win their next election. But what's weird about our system, and of course it's very different being in a parliamentary system, is that in between elections, you can change prime minister without any you know, member of the public being consulted. So it's worth going back to the story of, you know, why do we not have Boris Johnson anymore? So Boris Johnson, basically, he in a bit like Trump, he was consumed by his own bad habits. So he's a liar. His personal life is chaotic. He never you know, obeys any rules, whether they are kind of national rules or ones specific to the office that he held. And ultimately, he lied about, they were all partying during the coronavirus when we were all supposed to be in lockdown, and he lied about that. And then more and more evidence came out, and then he appointed a guy who had a track record of kind of, you know, basically sexual abuse allegations. He appointed him in a senior role as a party whip, and said, I didn't know anything about this. And then it transpired he knew all about this guy's background. So it was one of the, you know, the lies just kept coming on top of each other. And eventually even Boris's own people just sort of said, we're done with this. But the point here is that when they decide to change prime minister, it's just inside the Conservative Party. So that Liz Truss was picked by the members of the Conservative Party, the card-carrying members. Now, in the UK, probably a bit like the Republican Party, the Conservative Party is aging white men. That's the basic demographic. So the people who picked her were, you know, it's not a democratic choice at all. It's a little group of people. It's a bit like a sort of primary, I guess, but a closed primary, not an open primary, except that at the end of it, she gets to be prime minister. You know, it's a G7 country. We've got nuclear weapons. You know, she gets this position of huge power, having been chosen by, I think it's 80,000 old white men, basically. So it's a really weird, screwed up system. And I think one of the things that will come out of this turbulent period we're in is people saying, well, hang on, is it okay that you can switch prime minister without any kind of public democratic mandate? Because then the other thing that she's done, she's come in as PM, and she's basically said, well, we're tearing up the Boris Johnson policies and we're doing our own policies. Well, I think it's fair to say, well, what's your mandate for that? You know, who voted for this? And the answer is, of course, nobody. And so the combination of her seeming to be incompetent, but also seeming to be taking the government in, you know, in this weird direction, which is all about the small state and cutting taxes, which, you know, on paper sounds quite nice. But if it causes the pound to tank, interest rates shooting up, you know, as you might know, the housing market in the UK, not unlike the US, a lot of people's wealth is completely bound up with housing. People often borrow very heavily, you know, have very big mortgages. Sure. So if the interest rate shifts just by a few points, people are going to the wall. And so all those kinds of factors have all happened in the last 5-6 days, you know, and it's the kind of the madness of the incompetence of this government that they didn't think any of this stuff through. And in fact, you know, just to illustrate this, there's this whole a bit like the Congressional Budget Office. We have this thing, Office of Budget Responsibility, and it's supposed to, you know, vet any big finance bill. And Truss and her finance guy, Kwarteng, they said, oh, we don't need this, you know, and they cancelled the OBR, the office, from assessing their finance bill because they said, no, we don't need you guys to analyze it. And on a kind of technicality, they were able to do that, although it's sort of arguably not legal because there's supposed to be a mandate that they should do that. And so everyone's saying, well, hang on a minute. You were so sure of yourself that you didn't want any independent oversight of your budget. But when you issued your budget, you know, the currency collapsed and the mortgage rates went sky high. So they look like completely chaotic amateurs who really should be nowhere near, you know, they shouldn't be running like a small town council, let alone, you know, a fairly big country.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, last time you were on, you made a point about the Iraq war in the United States and how we borrowed so heavily to pay for that war. And combine that with tax cuts, you know, the result of which I think it was $1 trillion in tax cuts and $1 trillion for the war. Right. So we're out $1 trillion. And, you know, again, the math doesn't add up. You don't get rid of the revenue and then borrow. Nobody does that. So you don't do it if you're a person. You don't do it if you're a government. I mean, if you have to, you do it, but not, you know.
Right.
It's pretty basic stuff.
And what's increasingly looking possible, and I've seen reporting just before actually I came on this call, from the Sunday Times, you know, is a very credible paper, is that that Kwarteng, who the finance guy, so at one time he was working as an analyst in a hedge fund. This is several years back, but he's very connected in that world. And of course, the hedge funds, the short sellers, they've done brilliantly in the last week. You know, they've made out like bandits. And it seems that there's evidence that directly that he had a meeting before he issued the budget hinting at what his plans were. So obviously, you know, if you're a trader, that's great. You've got the edge on the market. And then afterwards, literally the day he did it, when they still hadn't realized what it had been, he was at some private champagne party with all these hedge fund guys. So now people, were you just the kind of useful idiot of the, you know, the masters of the universe, that the hedge fund guys, who they don't care if you're going to make it easy for them to make $1 billion shorting a pound, then, you know, that's what they'll do. So it looks like it's not just incompetent, but it might be a bit corrupt as well, which is, you know, it's pretty depressing.
Yeah, this is all a bad look. Thank you for giving the whole explanation about Boris Johnson. As an American, I want to say we think it's really cute that you guys got rid of him for having parties during COVID. Our former president is busy selling like classified information to the highest bidder at his spy ridden shitty golf course in Florida. Yeah. So it's, you know, congrats to you guys.
And he tried to organize an insurrection. You'd think that would be enough, wouldn't it?
No, but anyway, I don't know what would be enough at this point. It's crazy to me. But this, I was going to ask about that too, about this financial chaos, because anytime something like this happens sort of out of the blue, you have to ask, okay, why is this happening? What are the causes? And are there nefarious actors in place? I wondered if it has anything to do with what's happening in Ukraine. And not only that, but the mobilization and the fact that Russia now, they're you know, they're fucked basically. And I think that the economic factors working against them are going to continue to work badly against them, which means the oligarchs who have so much of their money tied up in London, are they cashing out? Is this a bust up, or is it just not just coincidental, or is it a little of both?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a bit of kind of, you know, the sort of doom loop that a market gets into. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if if some of these big oligarchs are pulling out, but just because, you know, why for years, you know, London looked like a pretty good bet. A lot of people made money in property. A lot of the oligarchs, as you know very well, piled into London property, super prime property, which has held its value. And you know, it's a great tax hedge, and you know, no one asks any questions, and you launder your wealth that way. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a bit of that kind of bust up going on. But I think, to be honest, I think a lot of this is actually closer to home, sadly, that, you know, Britain has had an oversized financial sector. You know, it's like the whole of our country is sort of New York State with you know, with a massive financial sector, but without California and the tech people and all the farmers and all the rest of, you know, our whole economy is overly skewed towards that
right.
financial sector. And that means these people are very powerful. But what is definitely the case is that both Truss and Kwarteng, they're in that part of the kind of conservative movement that loves to be around the finance guys. And I think they've been played. I think that, and a lot of these people are probably Brits, you know, they're not patriotic, obviously, but they're, you know, people in the hedge fund and the banking world. I think they played them. And I think they probably kind of encouraged them. Oh, yeah, you know, cut the taxes. You know, this is brilliant. You're freeing up the animal spirits. It's all that kind of Ayn Rand stuff, you know. But ultimately, these people can't remember 2008, which after all is not that long ago. You know, we're talking people who are not small children. They can't remember that when we deregulated all of finance, it ended up with almost the whole world economy grinding to a halt. So what the merciful thing here is that it's only Britain, because the rest of the world is still has remembered the lessons of that era. But it's like the Brits are sort of saying, no, 2008 never happened. You know, that was never a thing, and we'll just plow on. And in a way, maybe we're lucky that they got caught so early, because I could imagine them spending the next 2 years piling on all kinds of crazy, you know, trying to make Britain the kind of the loosest regulated major economy. And then we could have had a crash, you know, when it had got much more serious. But speaking of the, you know, the mobilization and the escalation with the Ukraine war, I think one thing that is highly relevant is, and maybe, you know, for your listeners, mostly in America, you know, Europe is very febrile at the moment. The energy prices, the cost of heating your home, obviously we're in October now, winter's coming, has gone up double, triple, you know, through the roof, basically. And there's a lot of nervousness, and a lot of people, I think, that are just, you know, they're so scared of what might happen, that there is always going to be a tendency for people to say, well, maybe we just can't do this. We have to do a deal with Putin. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's like coming from the UK at the moment, and actually, you're not France, not Germany. You know, the countries that you might expect to sort of give in are not doing that. The Italians, they're actually holding firm. But we don't know yet how bad the winter will be. That's the problem. And basically, you know, Europe has not completely gone off from buying Russian gas, but most Russian gas is no longer, you know, reaching Europe. And that means it has to come from somewhere else, you know, and that is complicated. So I think there is a lot of this kind of nervousness, volatility.
You know, we're recording this on the 1st of October. Putin gave the speech a couple of days ago. Was it yesterday? I've lost all track of time. Sometime in the last few days. He looks terrible. Yeah. I mean, his head is all he's clearly not all there. And I don't know, you know, we'll see. This is going to run Friday. Maybe it'll be a whole different world by the time it runs. We should be so lucky. You mentioned about the brilliance of Kwarteng. How does he say his name? Kwarteng?
Kwarteng. Yeah.
Kwarteng. Yeah. I saw in some of your tweets, you seem to be trying to reconcile his brilliance with his, you know, obviously making dumb mistakes.
So he and I are actually the same age, and I attended Oxford University and he attended Cambridge University, and I know people who knew him well, people who knew him at school. He went to Eton College, which, you know, is this famous, very kind of elite high school, and then Cambridge University. And there is this thing of, you know, how can someone so clever be so stupid, basically. I mean, it's sort of, you know, and I think there is this issue of how that kind of the arrogance of someone who most of their life, literally from kind of childhood, has been told that they are brilliant. And they've always been in institutions that they keep being told they're brilliant, and they win prizes, and then they from Cambridge, they go to Harvard, and then maybe they go to Princeton, or who knows. And sometimes people like that just stop listening. And interestingly, I've been told now by two people who knew him both at school, but later as well, that he's extremely lazy, but incredibly arrogant, and also highly intelligent. And I think that's just this incredibly dangerous mixture, because you end up sort of going off on a sort of tangent. You've decided in your own mind that this is a brilliant idea, and you don't need to. I don't need anyone's advice on this, you know, because I know what I'm doing, and I'm the cleverest guy in the room. It's a bit like that whole, you know, remember the Enron movie, the cleverest guys in the room.
Yeah.
And well, we know how that story ended. They might have been. I'm not, you know, questioning their intelligence, but you know, it didn't end well.
No, I mean, there's different kinds of intelligence too. I remember when I was in high school, there was a woman who was a classmate. We were at play rehearsal, and we went to this pizzeria, and there were eight of us, and yeah, we were going to go get slices of pizza. And she got a 1600 on her SAT. She got a perfect score on her SATs.
Yeah.
She went to Harvard. She was obviously really smart. And it took me like 10 minutes to explain to her that it was cheaper for us to just order one pizza and split it than to get eight slices. Like, she couldn't,
get that.
Yeah. She was thinking of too high things or something like that. I don't know. So I think there is that kind of disconnect, and it's you struggle with it. You're like, I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. But you know, that's how, you know, some people just, it just works that way. Before we get to your book, which I want to spend the second part of the interview talking about, you mentioned in the book about dark money in British politics. Which wasn't something I knew about. So I wanted to ask you about that. How does dark money work? Because it seems like here in the United States, you know, people could just spend as much money as they want and no one will find out. And is it the same?
Basically, that's right. So we don't, the structures are different. We don't have super PACs. But what we do have, our own kind of toxic thing, which is the unincorporated association, which it sounds as dodgy as it is. You know, if you and I, Greg, say we're an association now, we don't need to register. We don't need articles. We don't, you know, we can just do it and give ourselves a name, and then we can start donating money. And technically speaking, yes, we are not supposed, for example, to donate foreign money. So, you know, not Russian money. But if I, as a British citizen, am in receipt of £1 million from a Russian oligarch, but then I donate it as Arthur, the British guy, basically that there's no system for looking into that, you know. And and so dark money has played a role all the way. I mean, you know, we don't know how far back this goes, but just one case study, which is really interesting. In the last few days of the Brexit referendum, and we know, of course, that Vladimir Putin was very enthusiastic about Brexit, a hugely expensive ad campaign hit the London newspapers. And it was one of those ones where you get your normal newspaper and then there's like a whole wrapper around it, which is paid for by the advertisers, and it's promoting Brexit. And some people after the event looked into who had paid for this. And it was said that it was paid for by a Northern Irish political party. Now you think, well, hang on, it's a London newspaper, how come the Northern Irish party is paying for it and it's not a very big political party? Well, here's the answer. Because back in the 1980s, when there was a whole terrorist problem in Northern Ireland, they made it possible for political donors to be anonymous as a security thing, because at that time, if people were disclosing their identities as donors, you know, they might get targeted by the IRA. But the law continues to this day. So someone donated, I think it was like £500,000, which by American political standards is not very much, but in UK politics, that's a huge sum of money for fundraising to this party. We'll never know who that person was. And that party then spent it not in Northern Ireland, where they were campaigning, but in London. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's dark money for you. You know, just sort of laid out straight there.
Yeah, they use the loophole. That's a well-intended loophole designed to help people and to protect people. And they abuse it. I hate that shit. Mm-hmm. Okay, I want to talk to you about your book. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Arthur Snell.
Influencer. It's a word that gets tossed around a lot these days. But what exactly is an influencer? Well, there is a woman who went the distance, who went beyond the dazzle, who broke ground as the first true influencer by living a remarkable life. She had power, real power, and longevity, influencing generations. Her name, Elizabeth Taylor.
I know she was loud. I know she was hysterically funny. I know she swore, but Elizabeth said how painfully shy she was.
She went on perfume tours, and the places were mobbed just to see her.
She was starting to try and take control of her life, but then tragedy and life kind of got in the way.
I'm Katy Perry, and Elizabeth Taylor has fascinated, inspired, and influenced me as an artist, woman, and an advocate. This is the story of the original influencer. This is Elizabeth the First.
Okay, we're back with Arthur Snell. Your book is called How Britain Broke the World, which is a good title. I like the alliterative bruh, bruh there. It's very good. You're holding it up, but this isn't a video.
I'm
this
holding it up.
Nobody can see it but me. It's a wonderful book, and you know written really well, argued well, and you're not some schmo. You're not somebody that spent time just in the ivory tower, you know, thinking about things in hypotheticals and in theoretical terms. You've been all over the world. You've been to Zimbabwe. You've been to Iraq. You've been to Afghanistan. You've been to Yemen. You've been to the Caribbean. You've been to London working in counterterrorism. You've been all over. You've seen a lot of stuff. You're boots on the ground, so to speak, in very dangerous places for a long time. So you know what you're talking about. One question you pose in the book early on is you say, why are so many things so bad at the moment? So I'm going to ask you your own question. Why are so many things so bad at the moment? Because everything seems really bad right now.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a bit like is the Agatha Christie story is the Murder on the Orient Express. So the big spoiler, if anyone doesn't turn off your sound now, because when you get to the end of the book, you find they all did it. So, it's, you know, there wasn't one murderer. They all did it. And it's kind of where we're at now is that a lot of countries acting for different reasons contributed to the breakdown of kind of the international order. Now, and the reason I start with that point is that what I don't want anyone to think is I am excusing Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or, you know, these kind of autocrats. But actually, the UK and arguably the US as well have to take their responsibility. So one of the things that I identified was the way in which countries, particularly, you know, Western countries, NATO countries, the US, the UK, they tend to talk loudly about how they uphold the international order. And, you know, there's even that idea of the US is a sort of global policeman, which sort of assumes that there's a law and somebody's applying the law. And the UK is often kind of in the slipstream there, sort of, you know, joining in with the US, committing its army or its intel services or whatever. But then you have to say, OK, fine, but have you upheld it? Or do you just talk about upholding it? And what you start to see is that even if you go back as far as the Kosovo intervention, back we're talking the era of Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and, you know, guy, I respect both of them. My own politics are, you know, with those guys on the kind of liberal left side, I guess. But they ultimately, and I think Blair in particular, became the kind of architect of this. They sort of said, we know we're right. And we're right because we come from a political heritage that is forward-looking and internationalist and liberal-minded. And therefore, we don't need the UN. We don't need the rules anymore. You know, the rules are for the other guys. We're just going to do this because we're right. But the problem with that argument is, of course, is that it makes it so easy for Vladimir Putin to say, hey, you ignored the UN. Well, why should I, you know, why should I take any notice of the UN? And so we've all sort of undermined the architecture that was put together after World War II to try to keep the world secure. And I think that's the basic point, that this kind of structural architecture was there for everyone's benefit. Now, the counter argument with that would be, well, okay, sure, but the Russians would do what the Russians would do. Well, there's some truth to that, but I think ultimately we just don't know. We have to go back to the moment in 2003 when, you know, George W. Bush with Tony Blair and with a huge amount of support from the Brits, particularly on the intel side, told the world that they had to invade Iraq because Iraq had WMD and this was a threat to global security. And Iraq did not have WMD. And ultimately, that moment of kind of destruction of trust, but also a destruction of the kind of global order, that you can invade a country, you can devastate a country. You know, I mean, Iraq to this day is chaotic, it's violent, it's ungovernable, it's corrupt, and that was done for reasons that were really just inadequate and arguably illegal. You know, that because ultimately, if you say, well, we're doing this to defend ourselves, the US and the UK, you know, we must invade Iraq in order to defend ourselves. Well, come on, Iraq couldn't even defend its own land. How could it ever possibly have threatened America or Britain? So I think that is the sort of, to go back to your question, well, why is everything so screwed up? Part of it is about that taking the rules and saying the rules aren't for us, the rules are for the other people. So that's one thing. And then I think the other thing that goes with that, and this is very, very marked in the UK, is actually it takes us back to what we were talking about in the first half with Liz Truss and this sort of chaotic, incompetent government, is that particularly on the right wing in politics, you've had people for whom winning elections has superseded every other factor. So, you know, in the modern Republican Party, you know, whatever you do, as long as you win an election, it's fine. And so you don't have values anymore. You the rule of law is not important. The kind of independent institutions, you know, judges or other kind of guardrails of democracy, they're all out the window. And we've been doing this in the UK as well. Maybe not as much. You know, we happily have not had an insurrection, but we've had all kinds of other things where it's very clear that government is completely indifferent to the structures that exist to support, you know, adequate decision making. And what that does is it just makes governments more and more cynical, more and more ineffective, and you end up with this kind of populist nightmare. And I think it has a sort of pandemic effect. You know, it spreads from country to country, and it's not all in one direction. You know, sometimes good guys win elections, as you know, as happened in your country. But what it's very easy to undermine the kind of global democratic standards, and I think it's quite hard to build them back up.
Yeah, I think that's true. I forgot to mention, as we were leading into your book, the way that it's structured, which is that you go through different places and different basically mistakes that you say that Britain has made. And you were very diplomatic, saying that the U.S. didn't make any mistakes. We don't ever admit to making mistakes. We fuck stuff up all the time. And that the Iraq business in 03 with the weapons of mass destruction. Yeah. I have this idea in my head now, and it interesting reading the part of your book about Kosovo, because that's where you start in 1997 in Kosovo. Thinking about Tony Blair and the intentions that he had. Arguing against appeasement, right?
Yes.
It's interesting to me because I feel like he's almost 25 years early, and that the Blair Doctrine, so-called, applies perfectly to Crimea in a way that it did not apply to Iraq the second time around. The first time in Iraq in the Gulf War, you know, they invaded Kuwait. You're not allowed to do that. We send in troops. We kick them out. We're done. Right. Because that's what we're trying to do. We're not trying to overthrow the government. We're trying to get everybody to follow the rules.
Yes.
It seems like with Kosovo, and especially after Iraq and Afghanistan, but particularly Iraq, everybody in the West's appetite for these things, for nation building and all of the expense and politics involved with it was so drained that Putin just waltzed into Crimea and nobody really was willing to do anything about it. And now, you know, it's what Churchill said about the appeaser is someone who feeds the crocodile, hoping he'll eat him last. Right. So I just feel like Blair is just he was ahead of his time. Or am I wrong? Yeah. What do you think?
No, I think that's a really, really good observation that actually it's such a good observation. I wish I'd put it in my book. But because in a weird way, you know, Blair, he talked about Kosovo, which is, you know, a very small place being threatened by a fairly small country, Serbia. And I'm not saying that to be dismissive. Of course, the individual rights of those people is important. But in a way, he talked about Kosovo as if this was a sort of global struggle for you know, civilization. And also he did that with Iraq. And the thing about Tony Blair is he's an incredible communicator. And again, you know, a very talented and in many ways impressive politician. You're right that he should have been saying that about Crimea in 2014, because that was the problem one. And actually one of the ways in which, you know, we screwed up was that certainly the US and the UK, but we became very obsessed with this issue of counterterrorism and nation building. And we ended up putting incredible resources into Iraq and Afghanistan, both of which ultimately have delivered pretty much nothing.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, we didn't look at China and we didn't look at Russia. And China and Russia were both in their different ways, building up, making their militaries stronger, becoming more aggressive. And Russia, you know, maybe Russia will kind of burn itself out because they've gone so far now. And as you mentioned, you know, Putin's crazy speech and then this weird fascistic rally in front of the Kremlin. You kind of think this is because you've got this fascistic rally, but actually split screen in the same places that Putin's signing that he's now ridiculously saying are now part of Russia, his army is running, you know, and the Ukrainians are turning them over. So it's this madness of, it would be one thing if he'd kind of invaded like a blitzkrieg, the sort of Hitler style, and then he said, this is now part of Russia. I'm not saying it would be make it okay, but that would be from a position of strategic strength. But he's doing it and his army is losing the war. And so this seems to me that I'm not saying we know when it happens, but they're on a kind of steep slide, you know, like a sort of toboggan run down into the pit, basically.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I do know what's going to happen is it's going to happen when he leaves power one way or the other, because that's where it's headed. And I feel like at the very beginning of the war or the invasion, Biden, you know, we talked about NATO. I've said this on the podcast so many times. I don't want to repeat, and you know it. You know, NATO is responsible for the peacetime in Europe for, you know, 75 years, which historically is such an anomaly. I don't think people realize it. We are so fortunate to be alive at this time in history to not have wars. And you've got to go back to the second century Antoninus Pius to have that much peace over that much of Europe for this amount of time. And, you know, Trump is in there just trying to destroy it and knock it over. And as soon as that happened, Biden basically reassembled NATO in about, you know, the same time it took Liz Truss to destroy the British economy. to the point where even Boris Johnson, who was still prime minister at the time, was eagerly, you know, signing up for it to his credit. But the point that he seemed to be making is, all right, we know what's going on. We're gonna basically declare economic war because there's sanctions and then there are sanctions.
Yeah.
But to the way that I saw it was what they're doing there in Russia, it's slow, but it's going to be devastating when it hits. Almost like the flood, you know, it's in the movie Titanic where the water is coming up to the... And that's where Putin is right now. And maybe that's why his head's so big. I guess maybe he thinks it could float or something. I don't know.
I mean, I think that's right. But I guess the other thing is that although, you know, from day to day, we can feel frustration because you'll hear a Ukrainian general or minister sort of saying, you know, we need more weapons, we need more missiles. But actually, if you look at what we've supplied to Ukraine, if someone had proposed supplying that in February, everyone said, oh, you're mad, you know, but what do you think you're doing? And so we've continued this sort of escalation and support. And, you know, Ukrainian soldiers have come to outside Ukraine to train so they can operate new weapon systems, more sophisticated, more advanced systems. And we can see it's working, you know, and this mobilization. I mean, I'm sure you've seen these videos of guys being told, you know, guys who've got basically no military experience being told you get a rusty rifle. That's it. You know, everything else, first aid, provisions, that's mm-hmm. your problem. And then you just get sent to a front line where you're being just taken apart by the Ukrainians, who are better trained, better equipped, and of course, amazingly motivated. I mean, you've got somebody who doesn't want to be there, who's just been conscripted, versus someone who's fighting with, you know, to secure their own homeland. And that is where I hesitate to write off the Russians, because, you know, they do ultimately, they with indifference to human casualties, both their own and the other side, you don't know that they can't win, but I think it looks very unlikely now. And that is, if you're Putin at that point, I think you just don't know where you're going, because the one thing is that at the point when the war is lost, his days are very, very numbered, if he is in fact still president at that moment.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the smart play for them as a country is to, you know, get rid of him, blame him, and then reset, and then they can spend 6 months pretending that everything's changed, and then get right back to the fuckery like they've been doing for the last since Ivan the Terrible.
You're absolutely right, and if they do that, you know, within a year they can all be stealing money and buying yachts again, which is all they really want, and they just don't need to invade countries. You know, Russia has all this mineral wealth and all this, you know, obviously the world's largest country by area, and the sad truth is that the rest of the world will probably let them do that stuff as long as they don't, you know, threaten major sovereign countries around their periphery. And that's the craziness of it. But the Putins, the continued doubling down and the mad sort of fascism of this last bit where you just, with a stroke of a pen, take a huge, it's a huge area of land. You know, it's like the size of several states of the United States or whatever. And to really, I mean, nobody can really think that it's going to work. That, I mean, maybe Putin himself does. Maybe he's so you know. But it's more like that the gambler who's on a losing streak and just keeps piling in, and then they use their credit card, and then they ring their friend and they borrow money. You know, and it's just like you keep throwing stuff on the table, but you know, the house always wins, right?
There's nothing that the guys they're sending now in this mobilization are old and drunk, and it does not look like and we're making fun of it, and I'm laughing, but it's obviously a terrible tragedy for everybody involved. It's horrible for the Ukrainians. It's horrible for these people that are just, you know, one minute they're doing what they're doing, the next minute they're, you know, in Donbass getting shot at and you know, and hung over probably. Like it's bad. So you know, I don't mean to make light of it, but you know, I just hope this guy, the Russians are going to have to get rid of him, you know, one way or the other. Yeah. And I hope that they do it sooner rather than later. Here's a quote from your book that I really liked, and then I want to ask you about it. And then I've got two more things for you. This is a quote from your book. A lot of the bad stuff happening right now is happening because of Britain. Britain talks self-centeredly of punching above our weight, strangely stimulated by the idea that its virility depends partly on its ability to be disproportionately powerful, but it doesn't seem very interested in whether it is punching the right people in the right places or whether it should be punching at all. Mm. That's really good. That's a great paragraph.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So I guess my follow-up question to that is, what should Britain be doing? How do you see, like, right now, as you said, there's a lot of bad stuff happening, but I could also see the light behind it. Like, there's a world in which Putin is gone, and Iran, there's a revolution there, and Khomeini is gone, and there's all this like really positive upheaval. And here in the United States, we get rid of all this MAGA bullshit, all in the same like really small space of time.
Yeah,
that's it, definitely a possibility. And yet, there's also the possibility that the fascists are going to take us, and also the global. So, what should we be doing, especially the governments of Britain and the United States and people in the West? Like, what's the best case scenario? Yeah. What do you advise?
Yeah. Well, my view, so starting with Britain, and you know, the one thing, one of Britain's problems is that it And of course, this is famously your Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, was he in the just after World War II, said that Britain has lost an empire and not found a role. And that's, you know, that was 70 years ago, but we're still going around this same circle. And frankly, it's ridiculous, you know, and the whole Brexit thing was the illustration of that, that we decided that, you know, we are a European country because that's where the map is. You know, you can't, just because you're an island, you can't move around. You know, you are still in Europe. And but Brexit was British, the right wing in Britain, believing that they were too big for Europe. You know, they didn't need to deal with places like Belgium or the Hungary or Romania or whatever. It's like we're in the big league. You know, we only deal with the US and Canada and China and whatever. And the, you know, the boring truth is that for Britain, obviously, you know, we need to support NATO, and we have, and actually our track record there is pretty good. But actually, whether or not we're in the EU, we have to be very, very integrated with Europe, because ultimately, if Europe is going to be strong and secure, it's not just about NATO. It's also about having a strong economy, an economy that, for example, is not dependent on Russian gas, is not dependent on laundering Russian money, which we, you know, as our financial institutions started to be. And actually, then we have to accept as a country, as Britain, that we will work with other European countries in order to improve all of our security, both economic and kind of military strategic. And that's something that for a long time, British governments have deluded themselves that they can do the military thing. You can be full in on NATO, but oh, no, that economic stuff, you know, no, we're not in with that, that we don't do that. And that's just, it's just delusional. So I think that's one thing. And actually, the more we cooperate with European countries, the better. Now, the problem with this argument is that at the moment, arguing about Brexit in Britain is sort of like, I don't know, arguing about expanding the Supreme Court or something. It's like, it's a fascinating argument, but there isn't really any realistic way that that gets done. So in terms of reversing Brexit, so I think rather than, and I say this in a book, I'm not going to try to advocate that we reverse Brexit. What we need to do is just have the best relationship we can have with Europe if we're not in the EU. And that there are lots of ways that we could do that, and hopefully that will happen. And turning to the US, though, I mean, I do think that the tragedy of what's happened with the sort of MAGA movement is that you know, some of those, if you know, 15, 20 years ago, you took a sort of conservative national security Republican guy, perhaps he'd served in the military, and he said that, and you said, 20 years from now, your party will have people who actively support Russia in a war against one of your country's allies, and you know, believe that there's a deep state conspiracy, you know, to undermine America run out of the FBI. You know, these guys would look at you and say, no, come on, don't be ridiculous. Yeah. That's the left. That's not us. And it seems to me that America needs to kind of rediscover its national sense of purpose. I mean, you know, I hesitate to tell Americans because, you know, no one wants to be told what to do by some limey. But it's like, you know, what on earth is going on where people who would probably be profoundly offended if you said you're not a patriot, and yet they're constantly kind of undermining their own country and going down these weird rabbit holes about the deep state and you know, all this bullshit, and it just feels as if, you know, there is, as you say, the pathway is there. You make NATO strong, you see off Putin, you're not going to see off China, but you can contain them, and you can demonstrate that, for example, you'll support Taiwan come what may, you know, so you have these clear red lines. But, you know, I hear loads of people in Europe saying, well, Putin is hoping that he can get to 2024 and then a Republican's in the White House. Amazing that the Russian hope is that there'll be a Republican president. You know, who thought that would be where we'd end up, you know, in the 21st century.
Yeah, no, you make a good point. I mean, when I started covering all this stuff in 2016, late 2016, I really thought that, oh my God, when these Republicans find out that Trump is this in with Russia, they're going to lose their minds.
Kick him out, or they'll do, you know, 25th Amendment or something, you know.
Something. I just assumed as a given that the party of Reagan didn't like the recognize Russia as that constituted as the enemy. And I was wrong. You know, I was naive. I did not know that the entire party had been co-opted. And it's been, you know, there are people that have been co-opted. We have senators that went to on the 4th of July to Moscow and then came back and have been mouthpieces for Putin since they got back.
Incredible.
To the point where I wrote something about it in December of 2019, saying this is what's going to happen. It's like a sleeper cell. These guys are going to talk more and more. And then that's exactly what happened. Like it's not hard to find. I'm not trained in this stuff. I'm a novelist, you know, but it's easy to see. It's very blatant. So I do hope that, you know, what's happening now in the country, that this business of Trump stealing the documents and I mean, he wasn't, you know, stealing them to just have them in his file cabinet. No. If he stole them, he was looking to monetize them. And
Everything with that guy is about a deal, isn't it? I mean, So it's not just because he's fascinated in history and likes to sit there perusing documents. I mean,
he's not a reader, you know. No. I think there are questions about whether
he, in fact, can he read? You know, does he have that skill?
That's for sure. And I don't think he spent a lot of time. And then like the Saudis were at that lived golf tournament like 2 weeks before this all happened. The whole thing is nuts. But, you know, again, I think the country is under this weird hypnotic spell that I'm waiting for us all to kind of wake up from. And we may. I think we're going to. I'm hopeful that we're going to. But if we didn't, I don't know. You know, maybe we're going to have to go somewhere else. I don't know. We'll figure it out. But I think that, I don't know. I wrote years ago, if the Republic is going to fall, it isn't going to be because of this guy. And I stand by that. You know, it's not going to be Trump is not going to kill us.
He's not smart enough, is he? But I guess that then you get into the ones like, is it DeSantis or, you know, some of these people who are, they combine the sort of Trump politics with a much smarter and more ruthless, you know, approach, basically.
Yeah, I'm not as afraid of DeSantis because he's such a buffoon. I don't think he has the charisma that Trump has. I'm more afraid of maybe Kristi Noem of South Dakota, you know, somebody that's kind of pretty that they can, like in Italy, like with the, you know, last night, Fascist Barbie here.
It is basically Fascist Barbie, isn't it? And it's weird. There's a lot of that. You switch on Fox News and there's all these kind of very presentable people. They look nice, but they say terrifying things, and there's this weird sort of cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, I think it's intentional, but well, you'll have to come back on at some point after Putin falls. So maybe next week. So your book is called How Britain. Go ahead.
We get a new prime minister here, right? Roughly once a month. So I'm always happy to come back update you.
Prime Minister Beckham, we'll be excited for that.
Yes.
Your book is called How Britain Broke the World. Again, it's really good. I encourage people to go check it out. I learned a lot from reading it, and it's written very well. It breezes by. It's a good read. Congratulations on that. I hope it's successful for you. Again, Doomsday Watch season 2 is starting, I think, next week. The sort of programmed episodes.
Yes.
So please go and download that. And you are on Twitter at Snell Arthur, right? Did I get it?
Correct.
It's reversed. Okay, so excellent. Arthur Snell, thanks so much for taking the time. Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Zarina Zabriskie, Marie Kost, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John, Tally Briggs, Michelle Cantor, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. And until next time, we shall prevail.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.